That was the job. Gather all the points of view, the data, integrate them if possible, and present the president with some options, get a decision, and develop an implementation plan. Priebus knew the theory. Gary Cohn can't do it, Porter said, because he's a self-identified globalist. Peter Navarro and Wilbur Ross would never let him be an honest broker coordinator of anything and would never respect it. And he doesn't want to do it anyway. Well, Priebus said, adopting Trump's management habit of picking the person in the room, the closest at hand, why don't you do it? So Porter, the 39-year-old staff secretary with no previous experience in the executive branch, became the coordinator for trade policy and took charge of one of the major pillars and promises of the Trump presidency. Porter began chairing 9:30 a.m. trade meetings every Tuesday in the Roosevelt Room. He invited all interested parties. Priebus gave it his blessing but did not announce anything. It just happened. Soon, half a dozen cabinet secretaries and more senior staffers were showing up. Trump later found out about the Tuesday meetings because he was talking to Porter so much on trade. Porter had developed a close enough relationship with the president and had spent enough time with him that all the others apparently thought his authority to chair trade coordination had come from the president. In the meantime, Robert Lighthizer, a Washington lawyer and former deputy in Reagan's trade office, was confirmed on May 11th as the U.S. trade representative. He was the person who was supposed to be in charge of trade issues. On July 17th, Lighthizer and Navarro brought a large poster to show Trump in the Oval Office, a brightly colored collection of boxes and arrows titled The Trade Agenda Timeline. It was a vision of a protectionist Trump trade agenda with 15 projected dates to start renegotiations or take action on the South Korea Corus trade deal, NAFTA, and to launch investigations and actions regarding aluminum, steel, and automobile parts. It proposed imposing steel tariffs in less than 2 months after Labor Day. Navarro and Lighthizer began the presentation. Trump seemed very interested. Porter arrived several minutes after and soon began objecting strenuously, calling Lighthizer and Navarro out on their process foul. Since March 22nd, when he had spelled out the rules in a 3-page memo, Priebus had required formal paperwork for presidential meetings and decisions. The memo said in bold, "Decisions are not final and therefore may not be implemented until the staff secretary files a vetted decision memorandum signed by the president." Knowing how the Trump White House worked, the memo also said in bold, "On-the-fly decisions are strictly provisional." Porter said that several of the actions on the poster required congressional authorization. "You don't have the authority," he told the president. There had been no attempt to coordinate the arguments. "Peter and Bob represent one viewpoint," Porter said. "You need to get the viewpoint of Commerce, Wilbur Ross. You need to get the viewpoint of Treasury, Mnuchin. You need to get the viewpoint of the National Economic Council, Cohn. We need to vet and have a process." For the moment, but only for that moment, the trade issues gave way to process. Nothing moved forward. Chapter 18. By spring, Bannon saw that the constant disorder at the White House wasn't helping him or anyone. "You're in charge," Bannon told Priebus. "I'm going through you. No more of me doing my own thing." A chief of staff who was not in charge had become too disruptive even for certified disruptor and loner Steve Bannon. It was a major concession that Jared and Ivanka would not make. They were in their own silo, in Priebus's view. He could not get them into some orderly program. The whole arrangement was hurting everyone. It was hurting him, hurting them. "You don't think they should be here?" Trump asked several times. "No, they shouldn't," Priebus answered each time. But nothing happened. He believed he could go no further to try to oust Trump's daughter and son-in-law from the West Wing. No one could fire the family. That was not going to happen. The president would go as far as to say a number of times, "Jared and Ivanka are moderate Democrats from New York." It was more description than complaint. Bannon was convinced that Jared had leaked a recent story to Britain's Daily Mail about Trump blowing up at him and Priebus and blocking them from traveling on Air Force One to Florida. It wasn't true they had been kicked off the trip. Both had declined to travel that day. "You fucking set me up," he said to Kushner. "You trashed Reince in this story, and I know you did it." Kushner vehemently denied it and seemed offended at the accusation. For his part, he was convinced that Bannon had leaked a story to the New York Times about his December 2016 meeting with the Russian ambassador, adding fuel to the allegations that the Trump campaign had colluded with Russia. During a meeting in Priebus's corner office, Bannon and Ivanka got into an altercation. "You're a goddamn staffer," Bannon finally screamed at Ivanka. "You're nothing but a fucking staffer." She had to work through the chief of staff like everyone else, he said. There needed to be some order. "You walk around this place and act like you're in charge, and you're not. You're on staff." "I'm not a staffer," she shouted. "I'll never be a staffer. I'm the first daughter." She really used the title. "And I'm never going to be a staffer." The rift widened. Bossie, Trump's deputy campaign manager, still kept in close touch with Bannon even though he had not received a White House appointment. Bannon was running a full frontal assault against Kushner in the White House, and Bossie offered some advice. "Steve," Bossie said, "one of you is the father of his grandchildren and the other is not. If you put yourself in the president's shoes, which one of you guys is he siding with?" Priebus had his troubles with Bannon, but Bannon had fallen in line and was 10 times the unifier that Jared and Ivanka were. Priebus was still having trouble getting McMaster to click with Trump. When the National Security Advisor came to the Oval Office for scheduled meetings, the president would often say, "You again? I just saw you." McMaster's briefing style was all wrong for Trump. It was really the opposite of Trump in almost every way. McMaster was order and discipline, hierarchy and linear thinking. Trump would go from A to G to L to Z, or double back into D or S. McMaster was incapable of going from A to C without hitting B. Priebus found that McMaster was also a bit of a hothead. The Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, who had been courted assiduously by Obama, was coming for a visit to the United States in June to see Trump. India was the counterweight to Pakistan, which was giving the new administration as much trouble as it had given previous ones by hedging maddeningly on terrorism. Modi wanted to go to Camp David and have dinner, bond with Trump. "It's not in the cards," Priebus told McMaster. "We're just going to do dinner here. It's what the president wants." "What the fuck?" McMaster blew up. "It's India, man. It's fucking India." He understood the strategic importance of India, a sworn enemy of Pakistan. Outreach and strong relations were essential. The later event for Modi was a no-frills cocktail reception. The working dinner was at the White House. Donald Trump, full of emotion, phoned his Secretary of Defense James Mattis at the Pentagon on the morning of Tuesday, April 4th. It was the third month of his presidency. Pictures and videos of a sarin gas attack on Syrian rebels were flooding into the White House. It was a gruesome, brutal attack, killing dozens. Among the dead were women and children, babies, beautiful babies, choking, mouths foaming, parents stricken with grief and despair. This was the work of the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad on his own people. "Let's fucking kill him," the president said. "Let's go in. Let's kill the fucking lot of them." The military had the capability to launch a covert, top-secret leadership airstrike in Syria. Trump sounded personally attacked. Syria had promised not to use chemical weapons, an apparent reference to Syrian President Assad's agreement to destroy all his chemical weapons. "Yes," Mattis said, "he would get right on it." He hung up the phone. "We're not going to do any of that," he told a senior aide. were going to be much more measured. They would develop small, medium, and large options for a conventional airstrike, the standard three tiers. Mattis saw that the administration had been presented with a rare golden opportunity to do something without doing too much, but certainly more than Obama. In 2012, Obama had announced that chemical weapons use by Assad would be a red line. The next year, Assad killed 1,400 civilians with chemical weapons. Obama had the military prepare a strike plan, but he equivocated. He wanted to avoid another armed conflict and quagmire. It was Vladimir Putin, of all people, who came to Obama's rescue. The Russian leader brokered an agreement under which Assad would agree to destroy all his chemical weapons. An astonishing 1,300 tons of chemical weapons were removed from Syria. Obama basked in the success. In 2014, he said, "We mark an important achievement in our ongoing effort to counter the spread of weapons of mass destruction by eliminating Syria's declared chemical weapons stockpile." Secretary of State John Kerry went further. "We got 100% of the chemical weapons out." Classified intelligence reports dispute this. In 2016, DNI Clapper said publicly, "Syria has not declared all the elements of its chemical weapons program." As the Syrian civil war ground on, Obama was tagged with a strategic failure. The war had left more than 400,000 killed and millions of refugees. After the chemical attack, McMaster and his NSC Mideast chief, Derek Harvey, went into action at the White House to develop options. Bannon got word of what was in progress. It was impossible to miss. When Trump was on fire, everyone in his orbit could feel the heat. Bannon confronted Harvey in a West Wing hallway. "What the fuck are you doing?" he asked. "Developing options for the president," Harvey replied. "He asked for options, and this is how the process works." The process was precisely what Bannon hated. He saw it as tilted toward military action, toughness, with a momentum and concept of its own, America as the world's policeman. "Do something," became the mantra. "Fix it." They hadn't even answered Trump's question about exactly what the United States was doing with its large presence in the Middle East. Bannon saw Ivanka's hand at work. She knew how to work her father better than anyone. She took pictures of the suffering or dead babies to him in the residence. The gas attack was a true horror, Bannon understood, but a military response was exactly what Trump should not want. In sharp contrast, Derek Harvey was tired of being involved in managing national security policy to inconclusive results. Syria was a classic case study of words and half-measures almost designed not to solve the problem. This was a chance to maximize a military response. The middle option called for a strike of about 60 Tomahawks at one airfield. "We have an opportunity here to do more," Harvey argued to McMaster, "and we have to think in terms of hitting multiple airfields. They could strike with real impact. Take out their air power because that's a force multiplier for the regime. We're trying to shape the endgame and put more pressure on the regime to engage politically." Harvey said they should take out his air force, not 15% or 20%, let's take out 80% of it. That would mean using 200 Tomahawks, more than triple the 60 from the middle option. "Derek, I know," McMaster said, "but we've got to deal with the reality of Mattis, who is berating me for the direction we are heading here." Mattis wanted to be careful. Action in any form was risky. Russians were working at the Syrian airfields. Kill Russians, and they would have a whole new ballgame, a confrontation or a catastrophe. A National Security Council meeting was scheduled to discuss options. Bannon availed himself of his walk-in privileges and went to see Trump alone in the Oval Office. He told the president that part of avoiding unnecessary wars and overseas commitments was not responding with missiles the way his advisors were proposing. "Jump in and make sure you are vocal," Trump said. In a public statement on April 4th, Trump attacked both Assad and Obama. These heinous actions by the Bashar al-Assad regime are a consequence of the past administration's weakness and irresolution. President Obama said in 2012 that he would establish a red line against the use of chemical weapons and then did nothing. At the NSC meeting, the three options were presented: hot, medium, and cold. The largest option was a 200-missile attack on all the major Syrian airfields. The medium option was 60 missiles, and the smallest was almost none or none at all. The potential target list was large. In 2013, when Obama had threatened a missile attack, he had approved a target list including a government compound housing the chemical weapons program. It didn't make the current target list because Mattis and the Pentagon wanted to keep the attack as narrow as possible. Mattis had scoped it down just to the one airfield in the 60-missile strike. A housing complex at the airfield was also taken off the target list because of the likelihood that family members would be there. "If that's the standard," Bannon argued, "let me get some pictures of sub-Saharan Africa, okay? Let me get some of what's happening down in Guatemala and Nicaragua. If this is the standard for a fucking missile strike, let's go everywhere. Let's do everything." He thought he had the president on his side. "This will be another pinprick," Bannon continued. "If they were going to strike, do something dramatic," he added sarcastically. "This is very Clinton-esque," he said, deploying the biggest insult. "You're going to drop a couple of cruise missiles onto a runway that will be fully back up and operational in a day or two." But then the middle option advocates worked the president. Bannon thought it was insidious. Their argument was that this was not designed to start a war. It was really a messaging operation designed to avoid one. On Friday, Trump flew to Mar-a-Lago and in the evening convened an NSC meeting in a skiff. 14 people were there: Tillerson, Priebus, McMaster, Kushner, Bannon, Cohn, and Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategy, Dina Powell. Mattis was on the video screen. The middle option of 60 sea-launched missiles was on the table. The targets were Syrian aircraft on the ground, hardened aircraft shelters, storage facilities for petroleum and other material, ammunition supply bunkers, air defense systems, and radar. Trump had stepped back from his initial desire to kill Assad. He was unusually focused on the details. He had a series of questions about risk. What happens if a missile or missiles go off course? What happens if we hit a school, if we hit a hospital, or a target we did not intend to hit? What was the possibility of killing civilians? Mattis provided assurances. These were the best ships and men. Trump asked to talk on a secure line with the captains of the two ships, the USS Porter and the USS Ross, both guided missile destroyers. He told the skippers, "I'm going ahead with this strike tonight. Are your guys the best at programming the missiles?" Both captains gave assurances. Trump then went around the room and asked each for an opinion. "What do you think? If anyone here has a second opinion, I want to hear it here, not later." There was agreement, even strong support. Intelligence showed convincingly that the Russians would be in just one compound at the airfield. The timing of the strike, 4:40 a.m. in Syria, virtually ensured they would not be working around the aircraft. About 15 minutes before the Tomahawks would hit, a warning was sent to the Russians at the airfield. When the call was made, the Russian who picked up the phone at the airfield sounded intoxicated. Trump gave the go-ahead for his first significant military action. 59 Tomahawks hit their targets. One fell into the Mediterranean after launch. Trump went to dinner with Chinese President Xi Jinping, who was visiting Mar-a-Lago as part of a two-day summit to discuss trade and North Korea. As dessert was being served, Trump said to Xi, "We're in the process of bombing Syria because of its gas attack." "Say that again," Xi said through the interpreter. Trump repeated it. "How many missiles?" Xi asked. Trump said 59. "59?" Xi asked. Trump confirmed 59. Okay, she said. I understand. Good, he deserved it. And that was the end of the dinner. Afterward, Bannon called Harvey a warmonger. You and HR are trying to start a war. About midnight, Trump called Senator Lindsey Graham. Did I wake you up? Trump asked. Yeah, Graham said. Sorry. No, I'm glad to hear from you, Mr. President. I bet you are the happiest guy in town. Happy is not the right word. I'm proud of my president. Graham could hear a pin drop. You did something that should have been done a long time ago. 100 countries have called, Trump said. Graham thought, probably, maybe, 10. They're all calling me, patting me on the back. You know what the Chinese president told me? When I told him during dessert we just shot 59 tomahawks at Assad? Good. He deserved it. A blow to the Bannon model, Graham thought. Obama, Trump said. He's a weak dick. He would have never done that. And his failure to do that has cost about 400,000 people their lives, Graham said, pointing to the number who had died in the entire Syrian war. Trump kept talking about the kids. Burnt, peeling skin, horrifying deaths and injuries. Mr. President, Graham said, I can show you pictures like that from all over the Mideast. He didn't seem to know he was echoing Bannon about the worldwide human rights atrocities. You did the right thing, not because of how he killed these kids. He was just so brazen, telling everybody in the world, fuck you, and you said, no, fuck you. Graham knew Trump speak, meeting a fuck you with a much bigger fuck you. That's what you were saying to him. Fuck you. Here's what you've got to watch for. What are you going to do if they repair the damage to that very base and start flying sorties out of it again and drop a barrel bomb on kids? You need to get ready for that, because that's poking you in the eye. The problem was not so much just the chemical weapons, Graham said. It was the bombing of civilians. That shouldn't be permitted with any weapon. If you don't say that, Graham pressed, then all the things you've gained are going to be lost because he's just saying, fuck you, okay? I'll kill them another way. That's what Assad will be saying to you. This is a test. One and done is not the right answer here. You let that fucker know that if he takes off from that airbase and he bombs a bunch of kids with barrel bombs, you'll shoot him down. Whenever a commander-in-chief starts shooting, even with only 59 tomahawks, political and public opinion tend to actively rally around him. This was no exception. Trump was almost universally praised for a quick and decisive response. The next morning, Senator John McCain appeared on Morning Joe. The signal that was sent last night, as you said, was a very, very important one. Host Joe Scarborough said it was important not only to Russia and Assad, but to China and North Korea. And our friends, McCain added. A lot of the Arab countries are willing to be partners with us as long as they think they can rely on us. Scarborough observed that Sunni Arabs had felt that under Obama, the U.S. hadn't had their back. Does last night change that? It begins to, Washington Post columnist David Ignatius, who was among the panel discussing the strike, said. They want to see more. McCain praised Trump's national security team and praised the president for listening to them. That's what's most encouraging to me, is that he respects Mattis. He respects McMaster. Some of the highest praise came from surprising foreign policy experts. Anne Marie Slaughter, who had been director of the powerful policy planning staff in the State Department during Hillary Clinton's first 2 years as Secretary of State in the Obama years, tweeted, Donald Trump has done the right thing on Syria. Finally, after years of useless hand-wringing in the face of hideous atrocities. In the days and weeks afterward, Trump often told aides in the West Wing that he did not think the strike on the airbase was sufficient. Shouldn't the U.S. do more? He toyed with the idea of ordering a covert leadership strike on Assad. He had been briefed or read some papers on what nerve gas did to the human body. "Do you realize what it's like?" he asked at one point. He had a visual image which he described. The lungs fill up, breathing stifles, and there is foaming at the mouth, drooling, blindness, paralysis, uncontrollable vomiting, urination, and defecation, excruciating pain all over, especially abdominal cramps, seizures. The organs of the body become disconnected from the brain. After this, 10 minutes of torture, death, children, babies. He wanted options. They were plentiful. The United States military had all the imaginable lethal capabilities. What could he do? He wanted to know. Secretary Mattis was alarmed that Trump might order a second strike and worked to tamp down and discourage another military action in Syria. After weeks, Trump's outrage subsided, and he turned, but not quickly, to other matters. McMaster complained to Jared about his lack of authority to move decisions forward. Like most secretaries of state and defense, Tillerson and Mattis did not want a strong national security advisor. On one occasion after the Syrian strike, the president wanted some information about recent Russian and Iranian provocations in Syria. The U.S. had killed some Iranian-sponsored Hezbollah troops on the road east of Palmyra and shot down a threatening Iranian-armed drone. Trump had some questions for McMaster. What happens if Americans get killed? What are we going to do? What are the options? McMaster phoned both Tillerson and Mattis. No response. He summoned Harvey and lit into him. The F-words flew. This is your job. Get your counterparts over there. 9 hours passed, and still no response from either Tillerson or Mattis. The joint staff from the Pentagon arrived at the White House to brief Harvey. The Defense Department had some strike options, but nothing about what would happen if Americans got killed in the Syrian border town of Tanf, where U.S. forces were operating, or if a U.S. ship was hit by a mine. It was incredible to both McMaster and Harvey. No answers were forthcoming, but Trump soon forgot his questions. Chapter 19. I want an executive order withdrawing the United States from NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and I want it on my desk by Friday, President Trump ordered. Gathered with him in the Oval Office on Tuesday, April 25th, were Vice President Pence, Commerce Secretary Ross, Kushner, Porter, and Navarro. The president wanted to be able to announce it on his 100th day in office. When no one pushed back or offered any objections, Porter, who had been chairing the Tuesday morning trade meetings, noted that it could not be an executive order, but would have to be a 180 termination notice as required by the trade agreement. There's a huge timing problem with this, he told Trump and the others, because no matter how quickly you end up renegotiating NAFTA under the Trade Promotion Authority rules, it's going to take time. A renegotiated agreement would have to be passed by Congress, and that would take more than the 180 days. Porter was the youngest and most junior person in the room. We don't want a gap, he continued, and a period where we don't have any deal. We've got a timing problem. We can't just start the 180-day clock willy-nilly. The others were silent and only seemed to be encouraging Trump. Porter was appalled that the president was even considering a preemptive withdrawal from NAFTA. The trade agreement had been the foundation of economic and national security in North America for more than 2 decades. The agreement lifted tariffs between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Annual trade among the three was more than $1 trillion. U.S. trade each with Canada and Mexico was almost as great as U.S. trade with China, the largest trading partner. We need to have a process to make sure that we do this in the proper order, that we've thought through these things. Porter gestured toward Pence, Ross, Kushner, and Navarro. It's great that these people are here, but Gary Cohn's not here. Steve Mnuchin's not here. I understand you want to move fast, but we have to slow it down. I don't care about any of this stuff, Trump said. I want it on my desk on Friday. Porter went to see McMaster to enlist his support. McMaster had not been very involved in the trade discussion, but said he agreed that withdrawal from NAFTA would be a national security nightmare and an unnecessary one. It would rattle the Allies. I'm on board, he promised. An emergency meeting was called with the relevant cabinet secretaries and senior advisors in the Roosevelt Room the next day. The fuse was lit. It looked like they had only a day or two before Trump would sign. As Navarro pushed for withdrawal, Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly and others said a perceived threat that the United States might terminate was good leverage, but actually doing it would be catastrophic. The United States would be shooting itself in the foot. The ripple effects would be huge. It would roil the financial markets and lead to instant retaliation. Trading partners around the world would wonder if they were next. After the meeting broke up on his way to the Oval Office to go over the documents that Trump wanted prepared, Porter stopped Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, who had just assumed office. Perdue was a former Republican governor of Georgia, the first from his party since Reconstruction. Sonny, Porter said, why don't you come in? Wilbur Ross joined them in the Oval Office. NAFTA has been a huge boon for American ag interests, Perdue told Trump. We export $39 billion a year to Mexico and Canada. We wouldn't have markets for these products otherwise. The people who stand to lose the most if we withdraw from NAFTA are your base, the Trump supporters. Perdue showed Trump a map of the United States that indicated the states and counties where agriculture and manufacturing losses would be hit hardest. Many were places that had voted for Trump. It's not just your base, Perdue said. It's your base in states that are important presidential swing states. So you just can't do this. Yeah, Trump said, but they're screwing us, and we've got to do something. The president finally decided they should amp up the public rhetoric and threat, but not actually send a 180-day notice. Jared passed word to Porter. The president's agreed not to withdraw for now. Porter knew that everything with Trump was provisional, but he was surprised how close they had come to the edge. And it was not over. Pete Navarro slipped into the Oval Office for an ad hoc, unscheduled meeting with the president. The only thing we've done is withdraw from TPP, the president said, referring to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Why haven't we done anything else on trade? The staff secretary process is holding all this stuff up, Navarro said. Madeline, Trump called to his assistant, Madeline Westerhout, get Rob up here right now. Porter ran up the stairs to the Oval Office. What the fuck are you stalling for? Trump said to Porter. Why aren't we getting this done? Do your job. It's tap, tap, tap. You're just tapping me along. I want to do this. The president was serious again. Porter drafted a 180-day notification letter to be signed by Trump that the United States would withdraw from NAFTA. Porter was more and more convinced that it could trigger an economic and foreign relations crisis with Canada and Mexico. He went to see Cohn. I can stop this, Cohn said to Porter. I'll just take the paper off his desk before I leave. And he later took it. If he's going to sign it, he's going to need another piece of paper. We'll slow walk that one, too, Porter promised. Cohn knew, of course, that the president could easily order another copy, but if the paper was not sitting in front of him, he'd likely forget it. If it was out of sight, it was out of mind. Porter agreed. Trump's memory needed a trigger, something on his desk, or something he read in the newspaper or saw on television. Or Peter Navarro sneaking into the Oval Office again. Without something or someone activating him, it might be hours or days or even weeks before he would think, wait, we're going to withdraw from that. Why didn't we do that? Without a trigger, it conceivably might never happen. Sonny Perdue gave a presentation in the Situation Room on May 4th on the role of agriculture in trade. Sensitive intelligence showed that if the United States imposed new tariffs on China, the Chinese would retaliate with their own tariffs. The Chinese knew exactly how to inflict economic and political pain. The United States was in kindergarten compared to China's PhD. The Chinese knew which congressional districts produced what products, such as soybeans. They knew which swing districts were going to be important to maintain control of the House. They could target tariffs at products from those districts or at a state level. The Chinese would target bourbon from McConnell's Kentucky and dairy products from Paul Ryan's Wisconsin. Several days later, Wilbur Ross laid out the reasoning on the importance of trade deficits. Echoing the president, Ross said trade deficits are the lodestar and were a mark of our economic instability and weakness. The president was focused on trade deficits, he reminded everyone, and they ought to be focused on them. Porter took off his honest broker cap. Trade deficits don't matter, he said, at least with individual countries. That's an absurd way of thinking. His tone was probably the most disrespect that Porter had ever shown to a cabinet officer. Trade policy, especially the trade deals that we negotiate, isn't a primary driver of our trade deficit. That deficit depends on economic conditions, which country can produce various goods most efficiently and cheaply, the savings rate, and the value of the currencies. All protectionist policies are not in our economic interest. Well, Ross shot back, I've made billions of dollars and I've worked on Wall Street. I know how these markets work. You don't understand supply and demand. If the U.S. puts tariffs on China and they retaliate, we will be able to buy products from other countries. In the spring of 2017, Ross negotiated a deal with China for the U.S. to import Chinese chicken and export beef. He called it a Herculean accomplishment. But there was some serious criticism of the deal. A New York Times headline read, China surrenders little to U.S. in first round of trade talks. In a meeting at the White House, the president tore into Ross. I can't believe you made this deal. Why didn't you tell anybody? You didn't tell me about this. You just went off and did it on your own. And it's a terrible deal. We got screwed. Wilbur, maybe you used to have it. As an investment banker representing casino bondholders angry at Trump in 1990, Ross had struck a deal with Trump that acknowledged the value of his famous name and allowed him to avoid bankruptcy. I thought you were a killer, Trump said to the 79-year-old Ross. When you were on Wall Street, you made some of these deals, but you're past your prime. You're not a good negotiator anymore. I don't know what it is, but you've lost it. I don't trust you. I don't want you doing any more negotiations. Bob Lighthizer would handle NAFTA and other trade agreements. Ross tried to defend the deal. The U.S. would be exporting more beef, but Trump had tuned out. The president held a meeting on steel tariffs, one of his obsessions, in the Oval Office on June 8th. Gary Cohn, Wilbur Ross, Porter, and Secretary of Defense Mattis crowded in seats around the Resolute desk. We're ready to go, Ross said. I want to submit this report. He was recommending tariff rate quotas, especially on China. A high prohibitive tariff would be imposed if China increased its current rate of steel exports to the United States. Porter cited a number of legal problems. The Commerce Department hadn't consulted with the Defense Department as required by law to determine whether the imports posed a threat to national security. Yes, we have, Ross said. We've done that. I've never been consulted on anything related to any of this, Mattis said. That's all right, Ross replied. He had talked to the Assistant Secretary of Defense who dealt with these issues. He had some emails documenting this. Well, Mattis said, you never talked to me. Porter jumped in to point out that the law said that the defense secretary had to be consulted, not just someone in the department. These were the legal bureaucratic niceties that drove Trump crazy. Wilbur, talk to Jim. Get this sorted out, he said. I'm sick and tired of dealing with this, and get it done quickly because I want to do this. Porter saw the issue as an exquisite way to kick the can down the road for several more weeks, if not more. Mattis was helpful in drawing it out, later telling Ross he needed an analysis before he could give his opinion. Later analysis by the Defense Department for Mattis, however, showed that U.S. military steel usage represents less than 0.5% of the total U.S. steel demand, and defense would be able to acquire the steel necessary to meet national defense requirements. Chapter 20. Trump said he wished he had fired Comey at the beginning of the administration, but now he wanted Comey out. Bannon disagreed and offered this argument to Trump alone in the Oval Office. 75% of the agents do hate Comey, no doubt. The moment you fire him, he's J. fucking Edgar Hoover. The day you fire him, he's the greatest martyr in American history, a weapon to come and get you. They're going to name a special fucking counsel. You can fire Comey. You can't fire the FBI. The minute you fire him, the FBI as an institution, they have to destroy you, and they will destroy you. Bannon thought Trump did not understand the power of the permanent institutions, the FBI, CIA, the Pentagon, and the broader military establishment. He also did not understand the sweeping powers of a special counsel who could be appointed to investigate everything a president touched. "Don't try to talk me out of it," Trump told McGahn and Priebus, "because I've made my decision, so don't even try." Comey is a grandstander and out of control. By early May, Trump felt that Comey was vulnerable because of his recent testimony in the convoluted investigation of Clinton's private emails. He dictated a letter listing the reasons to fire Comey. McGahn told him that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, was coming in for a meeting. One thing Rosenstein wanted to discuss was Comey, and apparently Rosenstein also wanted to get rid of Comey, McGahn said. McGahn explained that there was a process here. The Deputy Attorney General was the person who oversaw the FBI. Let's hear Rosenstein out. This was a stall tactic that the White House staff was using more and more. Let's cool this off. Let's talk to Rod, and we'll get back to you with a plan. Rosenstein told Trump that he thought Comey should be fired. He had no problem writing a memo outlining his reasoning. He brought a 3-page memo to the White House. The subject? Restoring public confidence in the FBI. It stated that on July 5th, Comey announced his own conclusions about the nation's most sensitive criminal investigation, which was Hillary Clinton's emails, preempting the decision of the prosecutor and offering derogatory information by calling Clinton's conduct extremely careless. Then, 11 days before the election, he announced he was reopening the Clinton investigation because he believed it was a question of speak or conceal. This misstated the issue, Rosenstein said. He quoted 5 former attorneys general or deputy attorneys general agreeing that Comey had violated the rules. "Done," said the president. He could not have said it better himself. He sent a brief letter to Comey informing him that he was terminated and removed from office effective immediately. The plan to stall the firing had backfired. It had sped up the process. The Rosenstein memo had nothing to do with the decision, Priebus knew. The president already had made up his mind. Bannon believed 100% that the reason for firing Comey was because the FBI was seeking financial records from Jared. It was pure speculation. Ivanka had complained to her father about the FBI. As the months ground on, Priebus saw that if Trump was planning to or said he was going to fire someone, it did not mean it would happen. One of his favorite sayings became, "Nothing is dead until it's buried around here." It appeared for the moment that Comey was at least dead, but he and his story were not buried. Trump was watching lots of cable news coverage of his May 9th firing of FBI Director Comey. It was not going well. He had muddied the waters and contradicted himself on May 11th when he told NBC's Lester Holt that he was going to fire Comey no matter what recommendations he had received from Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein and Attorney General Sessions. In a long, rambling response to Holt, Trump stated, apparently giving some of his reasoning, "I said to myself, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story." This answer seemed very much at odds with his letter to Comey, saying he was being fired because of Rosenstein's memo severely criticizing Comey for his handling of the Hillary Clinton email investigation. The evening of Tuesday, May 16th, Michael Schmidt of the New York Times published a blockbuster story. Comey had written contemporaneous memos of his conversations with Trump. In an Oval Office meeting February 14th, while Comey was still FBI director, he wrote that the president had asked him about the investigation of Flynn and said, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. He is a good guy. I hope you can let this go." Trump hovered around the TV, glued to coverage. On CNN that evening, David Gergen, a voice of experience and reason who had served as a White House advisor to Presidents Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton during their impeachment investigations, sounded an alarm. "I think we're in impeachment territory," Gergen said. "What we see is a presidency that's starting to come apart." Porter could see that Trump was about to lose it at the mention of impeachment. The president voiced outrage that Comey seemed to have turned the tables on him. The next day, Wednesday, May 17th, Trump was in the Oval Office when he learned that Rosenstein had appointed Robert Mueller, who had run the FBI for 12 years, of all people, as special counsel to look into Russian election meddling and any connection to the Trump presidential campaign. Trump's mood deteriorated overnight, and the next day, May 18th, was the worst. The president erupted into uncontrollable anger, visibly agitated to a degree that no one in his inner circle had witnessed before. It was a harrowing experience. "We barely got by," Porter said to an associate. Normally, Trump sat behind the Resolute desk or in his private dining room, but this day he mostly stayed on his feet as he stormed between the two rooms. The president turned to his lifeline, cable news. He watched a two-hour block of Fox News and then most of the two-hour-long blocks of MSNBC and CNN that he had TiVoed. He raged at the coverage as top aides came in and out, Priebus, Bannon, Kushner, McGahn, Cohn, Hicks, and Porter. "Why was Mueller picked?" Trump asked. "He was just in here and I didn't hire him for the FBI," Trump raged. "Of course he's got an axe to grind with me." "Everybody's trying to get me," the president said. "It's unfair. Now everybody's saying I'm going to be impeached." "What are the powers of a special counsel?" he asked. A special counsel had virtually unlimited power to investigate any possible crime, Porter said. It was Watergate, Iran-Contra, and Clinton's Monica Lewinsky scandal. "Now I have this person," Trump said bitterly, "who has no accountability, who can look into anything, however unrelated it is? They're going to spend years digging through my whole life and finances." Trump could not focus on much of anything else. Meetings were canceled and parts of the day eventually scrapped. Porter had never seen Trump so visibly disturbed. He knew Trump was a narcissist who saw everything in terms of its impact on him, but the hours of raging reminded Porter of what he had read about Nixon's final days in office, praying, pounding the carpet, talking to the pictures of past presidents on the walls. Trump's behavior was now in the paranoid territory. "They're out to get me," Trump said. "This is an injustice. This is unfair. How could this have happened? It's all Jeff Sessions' fault. This is all politically motivated. Rod Rosenstein doesn't know what the hell he is doing. He's a Democrat. He's from Maryland." As he paced the floor, Trump said, "Rosenstein was one of the people who said to fire Comey and wrote me this letter. How could he possibly be supervising this investigation?" Bob Mueller had all these conflicts that ought to bar him from being special counsel investigating him. "He was a member of one of my golf courses, Trump National Golf Club in Sterling, Virginia, and there was a dispute over fees, and Mueller resigned. Mueller's law firm had previously represented Trump's son-in-law. "I'm getting punched," Trump said. "I have to punch back. In order for it to be a fair fight, I have to be fighting." Back and forth most of the day, the president rotated to watch TV in the dining room and then come out to the Oval Office in a frenzy, asking questions and voicing his anger that he had lost control of the investigation. "I am the president," Trump said. "I can fire anybody that I want. They can't be investigating me for firing Comey, and Comey deserved to be fired. Everybody hated him. He was awful." Chapter 21. Mark Kasowitz, the seasoned gray-haired litigator who had represented Trump for decades in divorces and bankruptcies, asked John Dowd, 76, one of the most experienced attorneys in white-collar criminal defense, to his office in New York at 4 p.m. on May 25, 2017. "We need you in Washington to represent the president, to defend Trump in the Russia investigation being launched by Special Counsel Robert Mueller," Kasowitz said. Several high-profile attorneys had already turned down the job, citing conflicts or the difficulty in managing Trump. But Dowd, a former prosecutor with a long list of prominent clients, jumped at the chance to round out a 47-year legal career with the highest-profile case in the country. "Oh, my God," he replied. "That's incredible. I'd be happy to represent the president." "It's no day at the beach." "I think I've figured that out," Dowd said. Dowd was both good old boy figure and hard-nosed investigator. He had been a Marine Corps lawyer in the 1960s and a mob prosecutor as chief of the Justice Department Organized Crime Strike Force in the 1970s. In the 1980s, he was special counsel to the Commissioner of Baseball. He ran several investigations, the most prominent leading to the banning of Pete Rose of the Cincinnati Reds for betting on baseball games. After that, as a defense attorney, Dowd represented Wall Street and political figures, including Senator John McCain, in the Keating Five ethics investigation. He had been a partner in the prominent law firm Akin Gump and was now retired. Dowd had a conference call with Trump and Kasowitz and then several conversations with the president. The Mueller investigation, Trump told him, was consuming him and his presidency. He had done nothing wrong. "John, this thing is an enormous burden. It interferes particularly with foreign affairs. It's embarrassing to be in the middle of a deal and the guy, the premier or the prime minister on the other side, says, 'Hey, Donald, are you going to be around?' It's like a kick in the nuts." Dowd said he would not charge by the hour. He would set a fee. They agreed on $100,000 a month, which was about half his normal rate. Trump instructed him to send the invoice to his office in New York, and he would be paid the next day. He was. The president was outraged by the Mueller investigation. He listed his complaints to Dowd. First, he had been blindsided by Attorney General Sessions' March 2nd decision recusing himself from any investigation of Russian election meddling. He had expected political protection from his attorney general and was now left unprotected. Second, Trump related how he learned on May 17th that Mueller had been appointed special counsel by Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general. It was absolutely outrageous. He had been in the Oval Office with Sessions when one of the White House lawyers brought the news. Sessions said, "I didn't know about this." He had turned to Sessions. "Well, doesn't he work for you?" Sessions' recusal left Rosenstein in charge of any Russia inquiry. Worse, Trump said, he had interviewed Mueller just the day before to come back as FBI director, and he had turned him down. Now Mueller was suddenly in charge. "So two times I'm fucking bushwhacked by the Department of Justice." Third, Trump said that after he fired Comey, the former FBI director had gone on a testifying and leaking crusade to state that Trump asked him to drop the Flynn investigation. "I didn't do anything," Trump told Dowd. "It's all bullshit. Comey's a fucking liar." Kasowitz concurred that he and one of his partners had investigated to see if there was anything that connected Trump to the Russian meddling. After a full month, their initial conclusion was there was nothing. The way Trump rattled off the denials suggested to Dowd that his outrage was genuine. Of course, that did not mean he was innocent. In addition to blaming Comey, Trump said he did it to himself by not having strong people and lawyers. Dowd examined the one-page Rosenstein order appointing Mueller May 17th. Not only did it authorize a Russian investigation, but it directed Mueller to investigate any matters that arose or may arise directly from the Russian investigation. Dowd had never seen anyone in justice with such broad authority. The president expressed his distrust. A lot of Democrats were on Mueller's team of prosecutors. Dowd agreed there might be a political motive. "This is a royal fuck job by a bunch of losers," he told Trump. Dowd's theory of defending a client is to be his advocate and also to be a friend. Trump began calling him at all hours, all days. Despite Trump's outgoing, in-your-face style, Dowd could see the president was very lonely. Dowd discussed the known facts with Trump's legal advisors and reviewed the material for possible vulnerabilities. Based on a preliminary review of the known evidence, he did not see anything to support a charge of collusion with the Russians or obstruction of justice. Perhaps the most troubling pieces of evidence were former FBI Director James Comey's memo and testimony that Trump had appealed to him to go easy on General Flynn after Flynn's firing. According to Comey, Trump had said, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. He is a good guy. I hope you can let this go." Comey said he believed Trump was asking him to drop the investigation. Trump denied he had said that or anything like it. "What did you say?" Dowd asked the president. "Well, I didn't say that." Trump said Comey had raised the prospect of Trump coming to FBI headquarters to talk to the agents. "And so I was asking him when he wanted me to do that, and he said he would get back to me. But I never commented on Flynn. I mean, as far as I was concerned, Flynn was over." Dowd continued his own inquiry, being briefed on the testimony of all known witnesses and reviewing documents. He wanted to establish a relationship with Mueller, whom he knew. Years ago at a Marine Corps parade, Dowd had run into Mueller when he was FBI director. "What are you up to?" Mueller asked. "I'm representing Congressman Don Young." "That crook?" Mueller replied. "How could you do that?" "That's our system," answered Dowd, who was offended that the FBI director would speak that way. Young was never charged, though the House Ethics Committee later rebuked him. Young soon became the longest-serving member of Congress. While Mueller had not yet made a specific request for documents, one would likely be coming soon. White House counsel Don McGahn did not want to turn over much of anything. He wanted the president to assert privileges, such as executive privilege. Dowd disagreed with McGahn. If there was nothing to hide, Trump's cooperation could help the prosecutor perhaps see it his way. He recommended to Trump that "we'd get a hell of a lot more with honey than we would with vinegar." "I have friends who tell me we ought to tell them to go fuck themselves," the president said in one call. "I don't trust these guys." Dowd argued that cooperation would speed up the resolution, and Trump eventually approved the honey over vinegar approach. Dowd recommended hiring Ty Cobb, an experienced Washington lawyer known for his white handlebar mustache. Dowd called him Colonel Sanders after the Kentucky Fried Chicken icon, as special counsel on the White House staff. Cobb would be in charge of the delivery of documents to Mueller and his team. Dowd couldn't do this because he was Trump's personal lawyer, and the documents were White House documents. Cobb was really brought in to override McGahn's advice to fight document requests. Dowd emphasized to the president, "I want to build a relationship where we engage Mueller, and then there are no secrets, and that can be done." Dowd went to his first meeting with Mueller and his chief deputy, James Jim Quarles, a veteran of the Watergate Special Prosecutor's Office 40 years earlier, at the special counsel's office on June 16th at 1 p.m. "We're not waiving objections to your appointment," Dowd said, "and how the hell you got here." Rosenstein's order was too broad, and no one in the Justice Department had the authority to investigate any matter they stumbled on.